Osiris.
Welcome to The Jam. I'm your host, Jonathan Shank. We're exploring the evolution of jam music through the lens of key genres, events, and moments, its connection to the mainstream, as told by artists, industry icons, and tastemakers. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by legendary guitar player, songwriter, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member, someone who's collaborated with everybody from Lady Gaga to Slash. He's been in my life for over two decades. I'm honored to have him here with me today. We're going to get into everything from the beginning of The Doors, all of his influences, all the way up through what's happening in his world today, including new music with the Soul Savages. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the legendary Robbie Krieger. Robbie, it's great to see you. Thanks for being here. How's everything going?
Pretty good. I'm still on the right side of the earth, so.
Amazing. Well, you know, thanks so much for doing this. And, you know, let's just get right into it. Let's go right back to the beginning. At what point in your life did you first encounter a guitar?
Oh, boy. That's a good question. Probably when I saw Elvis playing, you know, playing guitar. Around that time, I would say.
What were those early influences? What were those early artists that you were kind of gravitating towards?
Well, the first one I really noticed was Bill Haley and the Comets. And, you know, when they had Rock Around the Clock. I was in the boys' club in Santa Monica, and we would just play that record over and over again. And for some reason, it caught everybody's attention, you know?
You got the bug.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was really different than anything else on that jukebox.
And when you first start playing guitar, was flamenco an immediate style that you were kind of looking at or gravitating towards?
Yeah, pretty much. My friend had a guitar that lived up the street, and I immediately gravitated to it for some reason. You know, I was playing trumpet before that, and not too well. but it was fun, you know. But then my friend had this guitar, and I would always make an excuse to go over to his house, you know, just to play that guitar.
Amazing.
About 13 at the time.
And so you were just kind of honing your chops and woodshedding throughout high school and figuring out.
Yeah, and my dad had these records. He had a lot of records, which was great. Mostly 78s, you know. And he had these flamenco records, and I really liked those.
What's amazing is you can still hear that flamenco influence in everything you've done. I mean, all the way from Spanish Caravan all the way to what you're doing now. And in addition to being one of the best flamenco guitar players of all time, you really have carried this tradition forward for many generations to come. And that's amazing. And I feel like you've been able to really carve out a unique lane bringing flamenco to guitar to the mainstream.
Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, I'm really not one of the best flamenco guitar players at all. In fact, you know, when I first started playing, I was taking lessons and stuff, and it was great. But then I started getting into blues and all the other stuff, and the flamenco kind of took a second seat, you know.
So let's get into that for a second. So the blues and jazz and maybe reggae even, I mean, what were some of those other early influences?
Well, definitely blues. In fact, I became the vice president of the John Lee Hooker fan club at one point.
Amazing.
I don't know. Let's see what other types of music was. You know, it was too early for reggae. Reggae hadn't.
Of course, that hadn't even happened yet until the 70s. Right. Yeah, you know, think about Albert King and you know, maybe like Larry Carlton, people like that.
Yeah, I got into those guys, but that was later. I think the first guy I really saw that played a guitar and sang was Josh White. Have you ever heard of Josh White?
I don't think I have.
Check him out, man. Josh White, and Josh White Jr. was really good, too. So I would go to the Troubadour and see these guys. And Bud and Travis, they were good. The Smothers Brothers were actually...
Absolutely.
Yeah, they actually could play and sing.
And so then you end up going to UCSB and checking out the scene up there. When you joined the Doors, were you still in school at UCSB?
No, I was at UCLA by that time.
You were at UCLA by that time.
Yeah. I started off going to UCSB, but it really wasn't enough happening up there.
Yeah.
Like, there was a flamenco guy up there, a couple of flamenco guys, which was good because I got back into taking some more lessons. And at one point, my dad bought this flamenco guitar for me. He went to Spain, and I said, if you're in Madrid, man, check out the Ramirez shop, you know, because everybody knew about Ramirez. That was the best flamenco guitar.
Sure.
And I still have that one. He paid $200 for it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. And so you're at UCLA, and at that point, that's when you cross paths with Ray and John?
Well, John I knew from high school.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Uni High, which is near here, actually.
Yeah, West L.A.
Yeah, and John was in the jazz class, you know, playing drums. Mm-hmm. And there was this guy, Grant Johnson, who was a piano player. And so we would jam and stuff. And I pretty much just met John at that point. And we kind of split ways college-wise, because I went to UCSB and he went to Valley State, I think. And then I came to UCLA the next year, and that's where Jim and Ray were. They were at the film school.
Were you already writing music at that time? Had you already started the process?
Not a lick.
So tell me what inspired you to start writing music.
Well, I actually did write a few things, come to think of it. There was one called, we had this little band called the Psychedelic Rangers. And
Psychedelic Rangers?
Yeah, Psychedelic Rangers. We had started with this LSD and stuff.
From the Psychedelic Rangers to the Soul Savages. I love it.
Never thought of that. That's good.
Yeah, so you're writing a little bit, but at what point was there a starting point where...
Well, really, it was when I finally got into the Doors and joined the group. And Jim, of course, was writing the songs. And at one point, he says, hey, you guys, why don't you all write some, too? I'm tired of, you know, doing all the work here, writing all the songs. And, you know, that it was kind of scary, you know, trying to write something.
He's a pretty prolific writer.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, and that was really the reason I even joined the group, was because of his words were so amazing, you know. So I said, all right, I'll try it, you know. I said, what should I write about? He says, and this is all in my book, by the way, if you want to check that out.
Absolutely.
Okay. It came out about a year and a half or 2 years ago. set the night on fire. So he says, write about something that won't be, you know, that won't go out of style in 2 years or less, you know. So I thought, okay, what won't go out of style? I thought of earth, air, fire, and water. So I said, okay, I'm going to write about one of those things. And I'd always loved the song by the Stones, Play With Fire. So that that was fire. And that was my first one, Light My Fire.
Unbelievable. And
hell ever since.
Well, I mean, Love Me Two Times and Touch Me and some pretty great stuff. But Light My Fire goes down as obviously one of the greatest rock songs, songs of all time.
I mean, there's something about a first take. You know, about first takes.
It's fresh.
Yeah, it's the first thing you do, and it's everything that's been inside there waiting to come out, comes out.
That's right. That's right.
It's like a lot of times when you're recording, you know, your first take is the best.
What's also amazing to me about that song is the ability of FM radio to play it all the way through with that incredible solo at the end. And
yeah, I mean, at first they didn't play the whole, we knew that Light My Fire was our best song, because when we played it at the Whiskey and places like that, it was always the most popular. You know, they'd go crazy when we played that song every night. So we said, this is a hit record, you know. But by the time it was time to, you know, put it out, the point was the radio, AM radio was what you had to do at that point. FM wasn't big enough to have a hit record. So you had to do, you had to be 3 minutes.
That's right.
Or a little over that. But,
yep. 305.
So they said, you got to cut that instrumental out of the middle of this. And we didn't want to do that. You know, we said, no, we can't do that. Yeah, that's why Light My Fire is great, is because of those solos.
Absolutely.
It's nothing to do with the vocal or the words or anything like that. But there was this guy that had an FM show, and his name was Dave Diamond. You ever heard of him?
I have heard of Dave Diamond.
So he had this show on KBBQ, that was the station, and it was in the Valley, and it was the first FM station in LA, and eventually he was playing Light My Fire, the long version, and he would get in touch with us and go, hey, you guys, you know, this song, whenever I play it, people go crazy. They just call
That's
up
right.
and you know, this is crazy. He talked us into cutting out the instrumental. Says, you got to do that or else you'll never get on AM radio. That's the same thing the record company was saying too. So we finally gave in and cut out the instrumental part. And it was a hit.
Well, I'll tell you, growing up in Philadelphia on MMR and YSP, I always heard the full-length version. And
those FM?
FM stations. Uh-huh. And I always appreciated those solos and the fact that the full song was allowed to breathe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know what? Eventually, the AM radio did play the long version. They played that, and they played the Bob Dylan Subterranean Homesick Blues, and they played the, what was that one? Couple of other long songs.
The other long one I remember that will always get played in full was Cashmere by Zeppelin.
All right.
Yeah. Right. But you know, I don't know if this is
Chambers Brothers.
And the Chambers Brothers. Tell me about what you learned from Ravi Shankar.
When I found out about him, I couldn't stop listening to that.
Of course.
I would listen to it every night before I went to bed. In fact, it would accompany me to sleep. Ravi Shankar in London, it was my favorite one. And in fact, there's a song on my new album, Robbie Krieger and the Soul Savages, and it's called
Samosas and Kingfishers.
Yes, samosas. Those are Indian food. If you didn't know,
of course,
Kingfishers is actually a beer.
Mm-hmm.
That's the beer from India. And there's I actually use a sitar, electric sitar, on that song, and I kind of borrowed a lick that Ravi showed me.
He paid it forward.
Right, exactly.
I like it. So you were talking about the whiskey and some of those early gigs. Were you leaning into blues more in those early gigs? Or what, you know, how were you coming up with your set list at that time?
Before we had enough songs of our own? Yeah, we would do a lot of blues stuff. You know, Ray, being from Chicago,
of course,
knew a lot of those blues songs. And in fact, in the very early days, even before the whiskey, Ray would sing those blues songs because Jim didn't know them, you know.
Yeah, I've heard a couple of those recordings, and they're so much fun because they're songs just kind of out of different, you know, different people's catalogs that you were exploring. It was right. It just seemed like a really fun time.
It was. And, you know, Backdoor Man.
Of course.
That's a Willie Dixon song.
Yep.
And
we were just talking about Wang Dang Doodle the other day. Yeah.
So, you know, the version of Backdoor Man, you'll notice it's a lot different than the early Willie Dixon one, or the who else did that? I think it was either Muddy or Howlin' Wolf, I think. And our version is from John Hammond Jr. I don't know. Do you know about him? Well, he was. His dad was the head of Columbia Records, which is nice. And he signed Bob Dylan and a lot of big acts. And his son was into blues, and especially Robert Johnson. This guy, I don't know if you've ever seen him play.
I have.
Do you notice his rendition of Robert Johnson's songs? I'd say he's the best at doing that.
Absolutely.
Amazing. Anyway, his version of Backdoor Man is the one that we ended up doing. I showed it to the guys, and they loved it.
Yeah, and it holds up today. Tell me, you know, some of those early Fillmore West packages with, like, Chuck Berry and James Cotton and the Yardbirds, and what do you remember about playing with some of those bands, and was there any particular package that excited you at that time?
One time we got Albert King to play with us. Yeah, that was great.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And you know, I also know you guys were part of the one of the first Fillmore East gigs, at least within one of the first few weeks of when that Fillmore East, and they always would do an early and a late show.
Right.
Would you guys, how did you feel about switching up your shows between the early and the late show?
I don't think we switched them up that much.
Yeah. You definitely had a lot of variance in the set list over time. You felt like you would never play the same show twice.
Well, that was true for quite a while. And then, when we were at the Whiskey, we would do the same set a couple of times.
Yeah.
You know, we were playing every night, three sets a night or whatever it was. And at Ondine's Club in New York, we played five sets a night.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
We wouldn't start till 11.
Yep. Going all night.
Until 4 in the morning.
When you would get out into the open space in your jams, how would you cue? Who was doing the cues on stage?
Mostly Ray, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ray was good at that.
He kind
of, although you had to follow Jim too, because
of course. Yeah, no, there was a lot of space. You know, what I noticed about your band is you very quickly became a tight unit, but because there was no bass player, there was a ton of space, and that was always really interesting to me, how tight you you know, John and Ray were as a unit, but yet there was so much space in the music.
Yeah, I mean, you know, having Ray be the bass player as well as the organ player, he had to keep the bass pretty simple, almost monotonous. It was almost it would hypnotic.
That's right.
So he, you know, that really was part of our sound, and you know, we tried to have bass players various times and just never worked.
Every episode of The Jam features a slice of toast and jam pairing. Today, in honor of Robbie Krieger and LA Woman, we're offering a slice of avocado toast with everything bagel seasoning to highlight Robbie's amazing collaborations throughout his career and all of the artists he's worked with. Were you surprised by the mainstream success of The Doors?
Not really.
Because to me,
we always hope that it would be.
To me, it felt like you had a canon of hit songs.
We did have.
It didn't feel fringe or blues. To me, it felt like you had a full canvas of just hit after hit that really was, in addition to that, you'd built an amazing core audience, global core audience in you know, across the world.
I guess so. I mean, especially Spanish-speaking people love The Doors for some reason. It's amazing, really.
And of course, you know, after, after Jim passed, there's been an entire afterlife of The Doors. I remember seeing Eddie Vedder front The Doors and thinking, man, if Pearl Jam wasn't the biggest band in the world at that moment, The Doors with Eddie Vedder would have been the biggest thing ever.
Yeah.
Stadiums knockout everywhere in the world. I mean, that to me, I've gone back and watched some of those performances. They hold up today, and you just have Eddie Vedder in prime mode there, in prime peak form, and you guys.
Yeah. He was a real big Doors fan.
Yeah,
obviously, but I remember when we did the we had him sing when we got inducted in the Hall of Fame, and.
Powerful.
So after the sound check, we went up to my room, and he just grilled me about Jim for like hours. He was such a fan; it was crazy.
Well, he's a prolific writer in his own right.
Oh yeah.
So very happy for him to have carried on a little bit of Jim's spirit into the into the next generations. One of the other things that also blew me away is the breadth of bands that covered The Doors, in kind of the last few decades. Everybody from Echo and the Bunnymen, Billy Idol.
Just played with them.
Oh, did you?
Yeah,
a couple of
months ago.
Stone Temple Pilots, Duran Duran. Any favorites? Any favorite versions? Any standouts?
I think my favorite version was Jose Feliciano's thing.
Light My Fire, of course.
Yeah, because it was so different.
Absolutely. I've absolutely listened to that many, many times, and it's special.
Yeah.
Everybody should check that out.
I just saw him about a month ago. He was playing in town, and I went and talked to him backstage. And he played Light My Fire, and he'd never thanked me, of course. No, actually, he did. He said, "Hey, man, thanks for writing that song." And what was funny is I just had seen him the week before on TV doing Light My Fire. And after the song, he goes, "And this is my song."
he has certainly adopted it for his own and taken it to a new audience. That's
well, I mean,
sure.
To me, it's it says a lot about the song that it was the main song of The Doors and the main song in a totally different arrangement of Jose Feliciano. And that just shows you how strong that song is.
How strong the bones are.
Yep.
Absolutely. You know, I've had the pleasure of knowing you for 25 or so years, and what's blown me away about you over the years is your undeniable work ethic. But beyond that, your chase for the great jam, your constantly open-mindedness to collaborating with new musicians, and everybody from Lady Gaga to the aforementioned Eddie Vedder, Government Mule, Widespread Panic, the list goes on. I could spend an entire hour of this podcast just listing the people that you've collaborated with, Slash. And I've seen you collaborate with Little Feat. We're going to have Bill Payne on here in a few weeks.
Oh, yeah?
And tell me, how does it feel when you're getting up and jamming with all these people and they're celebrating your music, you're celebrating their music? And any favorite collaborations or dream jams or ones that are still left on the table for you to do?
One of my favorites is Eric Burdon. Eric and I played for a couple of years on and off. And, he was one of our favorites, the early Doors. We would listen to
House of the Rising
Animals
Sun
for all day, many times. The one I haven't done that I always want to is Bob Dylan. he was my hero, man, when I was
school.
We'll
have to make that happen.
Yeah?
Jeff Kramer,
are you
listening? Shout out to Jeff Kramer. And just kind of carrying that forward, you always were there for the music. You always were there for the right reasons. And I say that thinking even about McGillicuddy's and Marina Del Rey when OKB would be playing a gig there and you would come and sit in on four or five songs, Backdoor Man and 5 to 1. And
were you there?
I was representing the OKB, at that time. And 14 Below and, all of those old places in Santa Monica and West LA. And just to say that you were always there for the music, for the collaboration, for the jam.
Yeah, that's the main thing for me.
and are you still searching for it?
Yeah, sure. I just played the other night with some guys that I never even heard of the lead.
Well. Listen, I think that
you don't forget the music.
You don't forget the music. And one of my favorite collaborations that you did was you actually came by my 40th birthday and we had George Porter Jr. there. Yeah. And you played Hey Pocky Way and Sneakin' Sally Through the Alley.
Right.
And it was a really special night, and I just remember you and George, the combination of the two of you, the meters and the doors,
yeah.
The fact that collaboration was able to happen was really special.
I actually did get to play with Booker T last year.
Tell me what inspired you to get the Soul Savages together. I know you've been working with some of these guys for a little while, and what made you decide to make this official and put out a new record?
Well, during the pandemic, we couldn't play very much. And so I would just go down to my studio, which I have a studio in Glendale. And it's a pretty cool studio. And so guys would come. My friend Ed Roth, who he plays keyboards for everybody. I mean, this guy is an amazing keyboard.
He was with us for Homeward Bound.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he lived right near there. And Kevin Brandon also lives near there. Kevin is the great bass player that played with Annie Lennox.
Mm-hmm.
No, Ed played with Annie Lennox. Kevin played with Aretha Franklin. So we would come down just for fun, jamming. And then Kevin knew this guy, Lenny Kravitz's drummer, Franklin Vanderbilt. And so he would come down. And we were really just jamming for the hell of it, you know. And pretty soon my studio manager, Marco, would started recording some of the stuff. And, wow.
Shout out to Marco for yeah, the record.
Exactly.
Thanks for doing that. And I asked you earlier when we were hanging out if there were any vocals on the record. And I loved your answer.
Zero.
Zero. And I immediately thought of Booker T and the MGs.
Right.
And that was the first thing that came to my mind. The Meters would have also come to my mind, but Booker T came to my mind right away. And
well, now, did you ever hear me talking about that?
Because no.
I've just been doing a lot of interviews for this record, and I always say I want to do what Booker T did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
No, but, you know, I mean, I do think about a lot about Cropper and Booker T and their influences into this world as well.
Yeah, I got to jam with Cropper a number of times over the past 10 years, and he's great.
Yeah, you know, one of the most special things we ever did together was we got together a bunch of people on like 3 weeks' notice for Ray Manzarek and raised a bunch of money for Stand Up to Cancer. And we had, you know, Taylor Hawkins, a rest in peace, Government Mule. We had X and a bunch of other amazing artists that were with us that night.
Yeah, there's a video of it.
And Justin Kreutzmann, you know, shout out to Justin for carrying that through and getting that movie out there. And it really documented that moment and also interweaved some of the interviews that Ray had done at TRI Studios previously and some other good sound bites. And I just want to say that that night lives on as a very special one. And, you know, felt like you and John really just put a lot of positivity out into the world that night.
Yeah, that was great. And you know, it was... I have to take credit for that night a little bit because...
Absolutely, you should.
Yeah.
You were the motivator.
Well, yeah, because, you know, Ray had passed like 2 years before, or maybe it was more than 2 years. And, you know, his birthday would go by and whatever, and I'd go, hey, we got to do something for Ray, you know, got to have a night so we can remember Ray. And we kept talking about it and talking about it. Nobody ever did anything. So finally, his birthday was coming up again. And it was like, you know, February 12th.
Mm-hmm.
And it was already January. And so I said, hey, man, we got to do something. If you guys don't, I'm talking to
Don
now.
You said something to me, yeah.
I said, if we don't do something, I'm just going to do it myself at the whiskey or something, you know. And we got it.
It was great, and I'm so happy that it was filmed and documented. And one of the special things I remember about that night, also Andrew Watt was on that show and gave an incredible performance of L.A. Woman, and it was a stage, you know, jumped into the audience, unbelievable energy, and now he's the best producer in the world, just on the Rolling Stones and Elton John and Ozzy. And shout out to you, Andrew. What an epic performance you put on that night.
I'll always remember that. He lied down on the floor and he was kind of grinding, you know. And so I came in back of him with my guitar and I pretended to get him from the rear with my guitar.
A story about that, actually, about how he came to be on that show is that I got a call from Taylor Hawkins a few days before the show, and he said, hey, there's this kid, and I want you to show him to Robbie and John. He's amazing, and I think that he would put on a great performance. And at that point, he wasn't the prolific producer that he is now. He actually was trying his hand at being an artist and super talented guy. And so I, of course, trusted Taylor's instinct. How many times does Taylor Hawkins call you with a recommendation? And so I remember I passed it on to you guys, and we said, yeah, you know, let's give him a shot. He was in Vegas, so I texted him, and I said, get your butt over here. You know, this show is happening. And he did on very little or no rehearsal. I remember there was a sound check that he was part of.
Right.
And he was one of the best performances of the night.
He did a good job.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
And I saw him last year. We played together again at the one of the hotels in Hollywood, and with Miley. You know, he produced her.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Amazing.
Yeah. So, one of the last times that we raised money together for the homeless, I actually remember you brought an extra guitar that we auctioned off during the event, and you were actually on stage, you know, kind of playing the guitar while we were auctioning it off. And that was an amazing moment. And then you guys did a set of a five or six Doors songs with Chris Novoselic from Nirvana,
right.
Mika Nelson, Haley Reinhardt, Fitz from Fitz and the Tantrums. And that was an amazing night. And also, just to say, you guys sounded as fresh as ever, and you know, it was all for the cause, for the music and the
that
cause.
That was a good night. Yeah, Ed Roth was there too.
That's right.
Keyboards.
Yeah, what a great band that was assembled that evening.
That was pretty good.
You're always great at assembling superstar bands and always calling up. I remember you said, oh, you know, let's get Haley, let's get Mika, you know. And I remember Chris really wanted to play with you guys.
Yeah,
and what a great soul he is.
Yeah, a nice guy.
You know, and really fun to hear bass as part of those songs as well. Tell me, are you going to tour with the Soul Savages?
I hope so. You know, if we can get it on enough radio shows, stations, which is what we're trying to do right now, then we will. I'd like to do some festivals, you know.
I think you would crush the festivals, absolutely. Well, everybody get out there and...
Monterey Jazz Festival.
Everybody get out there and check out Robbie Krieger and the Soul Savages when they come to town. Every episode of The Jam features some exclusive music. Today we're going to be featuring the Roadhouse Blues from the Homeward Bound Benefit, the aforementioned that we were just talking about. In addition, we're going to be listening to the Sneakin' Sally Through the Alley with George Porter Jr. and Robbie Krieger. Just want to say thank you to Robbie for being here today. It's such a pleasure and an honor to have you here. You're such a legend, and we could sit here and talk forever. Also want to thank Marco, Max, and everybody on Robbie's team, Osiris Media, RJ, Matt, and everybody over there, Angel, Robert, everybody here at the Sony Studios, and Emily Frost for being here as well today. Thank you all for being here on The Jam, and we'll see you next time. Oh,
your vow.
Thank you.
sounded through the just to look at me as if I was a crazy, yeah. Oh, did I even find a lie? So I began to try to explain. Got it, don't stop, don't stop. Just wonder what you're talking about. I've got to find something to do with my time. The past is, oh, I'm just saying, no. Sneak and sally through the alley. Whoa, whoa. Sneak and sally through the alley. I'm just running around, it's all right. Till it fucks up my home life. Sneak and sally through the alley. Oh, you know I gotta take care of my business, yeah.
Lisa, baby.
Will it fly high like a bird up in the sky?
gonna fly high like a bird up in the sky. Y'all, how about it, bro? Over there for Brother Robbie Creevy, over there on the guitar.
The Jam is hosted by Jonathan Shank, produced by RJB for Osiris Media, audio production by Matt Dwyer, recorded at Sony Music Studios in Culver City, music by Amar Sastry. Special thanks to Angel and Rob at Sony Studios, Emily Frost and Josh Winnick. Thanks for listening to The Jam, and see you next time.
Osiris.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street Podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the corner of Gray Street.